Chris White from White Labs joins me this week to talk about producing commercial beer yeast. This is Beersmith Podcast number 210.
This is the Beersmith Home Brewing Show, where brewing great beer is our passion. If you want to take your brewing to the next level, visit beersmith.com, where you can download a trial version of our Beersmith software, subscribe to the newsletter, and get dozens of free articles on home brewing. And now, your host and the author of Home Brewing with Beersmith, Brad Smith.
This is Beersmith Podcast number 210, and it's mid-March 2020. Chris White joins me to discuss commercial beer yeast production. Thank you to this week's sponsors, Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine. Every issue of Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine is packed with articles for homebrewers and beer lovers. They're currently offering 20% off their all-access subscription pass, with access to videos, brewing courses, exclusive articles, and the Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine. Go to beerandbrewing.com/beersmith to get your all-access pass today. Again, that's beerandbrewing.com/beersmith. And also the BrewEasy. Brew big in small spaces with the best all-grain, ultra-compact system available. The BrewEasy's revolutionary setup combines batch barge efficiency, brew-in-a-bag simplicity, and the work clarification of a rim system. It's easy to set up, easy to operate, and easy on the eyes. Add the optional Brew Commander for precise temperature control and mash automation. With the BrewEasy, you'll discover definitive proof that size isn't everything. Electric and propane models are available. It's also the system that I brew on. Visit BlickmanEngineering.com for more information. Again, that's BlickmanEngineering.com. And finally, I urge you to give Beersmith 3 brewing software a try. Beersmith 3 adds mead, wine, and cider recipe support to the Beersmith beer platform, along with new integrated water profile and mash pH tools. Dozens of new features, including cloud folders, updated databases, support for fruit, juice, and honey, as well as new Whirlpool hop options. Download your free 21-day trial today from beersmith.com and give it a try. And now let's jump into this week's episode. Today on the show, I welcome back Dr. Chris White. Chris is the president of White Labs, Inc. and a top provider of brewing yeast worldwide, as well as a 2015 winner of the AHA Governing Committee Award for a lifetime of achievement in brewing. He's also the author of the book Yeast, which is the Bible for brewing yeast. Chris, it's fantastic to have you back on the show.
Hi, Brad. It's great to be back. Thanks for having me on.
So you're in San Diego today, I think, right?
Yep, I'm in San Diego, and not a lot of travel on my schedule right now. So, yeah, happy to be on the show.
You're usually living off an airplane in a suitcase somewhere, I think, right?
Yeah, and then I don't usually kind of over the holidays, you know, December, January. So that was going to turn into a big travel schedule for me, and which is not going to happen, which is fine. It's nice to be home. Yeah. In some ways, you know, that part's great, being home and with family, and then be able to help around White Labs.
Well, I appreciate you coming on fairly short notice. I had a whole bunch of cancellations because of all the things going on in the world right now. How have you been managing with your production and operations there?
Well, it's something that kind of consumes all day, every day right now, planning for this, working with our staff, working with our production, our customers. And our staff has been great. Our mission has been keeping everybody employed. Everybody's working less hours. We are making yeast. We're delivering yeast. We're doing all of our lab work on a really, you know, reduced level, clean, sanitary, a lot of things to make employees safe. That's the number one priority. Most of the office folks and support, you know, staff are working from home. And everybody is pitching in. Everybody also wants to, you know, keep working as much as possible. And understands the situation. We're all in it together.
Awesome. I think things are picking up maybe a little bit in homebrewing. I think some people being stuck at home are turning to homebrewing, but I would imagine commercial sales are probably down a bit.
Yeah, commercial sales are down a lot. So, you know, that's where most of our yeast is sold. And breweries are slowing down, shutting down. They're doing some to-go sales. They're doing some crowler sales. We started selling beer from our brewery in California, and we're doing that in around Asheville as well in delivery. But that still is going to amount to a little bit, right? People are just trying to keep their businesses open a little bit, keep their staff with jobs. And yeah. So I think if everybody can support the craft breweries and restaurants as much as possible through those programs, I think that's really helpful.
Yeah, we're seeing a lot of curbside delivery, I think, from a lot of the smaller breweries. And then also, at least, you know, like my local homebrew shop, they have curbside delivery and pickup now, too. You can place an order online and, you know, go and pick it up right outside the shop, which is great.
That's great. And in California, they also, the ABC, the California ABC, relaxed some of the restrictions even on restaurants. So they can sell to-go beer and cocktails and wine. And, you know, that helps a little bit with to matching the food they're trying to do, some of the restaurants. But, you know, I live downtown San Diego, and it's just a ghost town. Most of the restaurants have done the numbers, and it's just better for them to close right now than to try to stay open, which is a more expensive option. But the ones that are doing it, it's really nice to help them out because they're not doing it for profit. They're doing it to keep some of the staff.
Yeah, I know some of them have gift card options too, where you can buy a gift card and support the operation, you know, temporarily. So, Well, today,
and you're right. Homebrewing. Homebrewing. We have seen it go up. It started last week. This week was stronger, and the homebrew stores are getting a lot of interest. There's new homebrewers coming into the stores or through online, and we haven't seen that in a decade. So yeah, that's nice.
Yeah, I think we talked. Homebrewing's been in decline since I don't know, like 2013, I think. So it's quite a long time, really. So it is nice to see, things pick up a little bit here. And I mentioned, I think most of the large online stores are still shipping, and also many of the local stores are offering curbside pickup options too. So,
right.
But today I want to discuss how you actually grow and create yeast. So let's start at the beginning and talk about your yeast bank. What's a yeast bank, first of all?
Well, that's a real critical part of a yeast lab. It's the entire collection of our yeast strains frozen at minus 80 degrees Celsius. And we have a yeast culture team that only works with the freezers. They're the only ones allowed in the freezer. And we maintain those strains with that group. They're the ones that take the strains out to create working plates. They're the ones that, you know, and then get the culture to a point where it's available for production. So they're working with the freezers to get them into production. And they're also working with new strains that are coming in to get them into freezers.
That's pretty awesome. So, how many yeast roughly do you have in your yeast bank today?
There's around 1,000 strains. In our freezes, and we make about 100 a week of 70 core strains, a bunch of vault strains, a bunch of private strains, and a few other things we do. So that all has to be scheduled into production runs between Asheville, San Diego, and Copenhagen. San Diego having the largest production. Asheville's pretty close now to San Diego in production levels, and Copenhagen smaller. So the production team, the planning team that's based in San Diego, coordinates how that yeast culture team works with the freezes to get the strains ready to get the production slots filled, because you only have so many reactors to make all those strains based on the orders we have and what we need to make.
That's pretty awesome. And are they stored in slants? Is that the correct term, or how does that work? And you mentioned stored freezing at what, minus 80 degrees Celsius?
Yeah, that's the way you cryogenically, you know, or liquid nitrogen is really cryogenic, but that's how you store them forever. that's where they don't change. Even on petri dishes and slants, so kind of plates and slants, those the colonies grow on some media, but they will mutate over a few months because they're still slowly growing, even at refrigerator temperatures. So what we you can the deep freezes are the permanent bank, and then you have things you're working from there. Then people usually go to petri dishes, and then sometimes slants. The difference with petri dishes, plates, and slants are that the slants have a little longer shelf life for the yeast because that screw cap doesn't have air like can get into a petri dish. Will dry out a little bit. And so a lot of the biotech world, a lot of even large breweries will work on slants because of that shelf life issue. But we don't keep our cultures on media for very long. So we don't really use slants. We might sell yeast to some larger breweries on slants, but we go from our freezes to what we call working plates, where we make sure we've got uniform colonies and the correct culture. And then we create, we call that freeze plate. Then we go to working plates. And from those working plates, we take the colonies from those to begin our culturing. So slants are not really part of our production. They're not needed in our production because we don't want to hold those for more than 30 days.
Right. How do you make sure that you have a pure yeast sample? I guess I assume the ones that you have deep frozen are 100% pure somehow, but how do you make sure you only have one strain of yeast to start with?
Yeah, you do a lot of work before you make freeze to make sure you make a freeze of a single culture. And then when you take it out of the freezes, just as another backup, another QC standards, those freeze plates, we will look again for uniform colonies. We will do mini fermentations. This is before anything gets back to a working plate. So the mini fermentations, we're looking for the right attenuation, the right flocculation, the right flavor compounds. We will PCR to confirm what we're looking for from that culture.
So, I mean, you're doing a lot of testing all the way along as you're building up this sample into something usable, right?
Correct. And that's really why this is a lab scale propagation and a lab scale company. Mm-hmm. There are, you know, in the industry and things that I would call propagation, or, you know, in breweries themselves, they'll do a propagation, but they're not necessarily maintaining the yeast bank the way we've invested in. And that's why even large companies, large breweries and things, and distilleries and such that have their own culture will use us to store, or even as a backup for their own systems, that strain in our yeast bank as a private strain.
So you got it up to let's say a petri dish or something like that in the lab. How do you then build that up to something you can actually create production volumes from?
So then our production planners will say, okay, because we start yeast from those petri dishes 7 days a week, every day, except right now. In a reduced schedule. But so there's yeast to start from those petri dishes every day. That comes from the production planners. It's going to be available for sale in about 17 days from that, which includes the propagation time and the testing time, right? Mm-hmm. If you can't just make yeast in a few days, you can, but where's the testing?
Right.
So the testing is part of our 17-day process. So they'll have the folks in the microbiology lab will have their starts. So they'll take from the petri dishes, which are a lot numbered and everything, part of the whole. So they're told their list of what says start has the lot numbers and things on the plates. So they'll pull those, they'll inoculate those into small volumes of sterile wort that's been autoclaved. It's brewer's wort. made in our brewery, but then sterilized in autoclave on the lab scale.
Oh, so the autoclave, I guess, gives you, sterilizes it, right? Yeah.
Right, because everything we're doing in brewing is boiling, and some of the industries don't even boil, but brewing does. And so that gives you a very clean starting material when you make your beer, but it's not sterile.
Right.
You know, that's 100 degrees C, you know, boiling, but the sterilizing is 125, 250 Fahrenheit.
So you have to do that in a pressure vessel of some kind, right?
Correct. So for the larger volumes, so the lab scale volumes are pulled and then autoclave. The production volumes, once these sizes get into the larger reactors, come from a pressurized large volume boil.
So I'm imagining you're making, you know, something akin to a sterile starter, right?
Yeah, and homebrewers can do that with a pressure cooker. You know, those aren't very expensive. You can sterilize 100 mil or maybe even liter bottles, depending on what size your pressure cooker, and with a loose cap that's then closed completely once you take them out. But you've got to have a loose cap so the steam gets everywhere mm-hmm. and the pressure can equilibrate everywhere. Because it's that pressure that raises the temperature in the pressure cooker that gives you the sterilization, basically killing all the spores, killing all the other things that may survive a boil.
Now, in general, so, I don't need to do that, right? But we could do it, right?
Yeah, and most breweries, as I said, that propagate yeast, perhaps say they grow it up and up, they'll use wort from the brew house. They won't sterilize it either, but it's important on the small scale, even though we do on the large scale, just to ensure the right conditions and the right yeast. On the lab scale, if you're not sterilizing, you're not doing it right. So if a home brewer, for example, wanted to start yeast from a petri dish, they need a pressure cooker or an autoclave. Otherwise, you're going to have a non-pure yeast sample at the end.
Okay, so you step this thing up to, I assume, at least some number of liters, right? And then you're going to actually now bring it over to the production equipment, right? What does a production equipment actually look like?
Yeah, so after the time in the lab, so you can start at 5 mils or 10 mils. You wouldn't really want to do much more than that. Some people go right from a petri dish to 50 mils. That's too much.
Okay.
So say it's 10 mils. You go increments of 10 up every 2 days. So 10 mils, 100 mils, 1 liter, 10 liters, 100 liters. And see, I've done 2 days every step there. 1 day is not enough. It's not as good yeast. So again, people sometimes compress that. But you need to give the yeast the time to develop the right physiology, so they're going to have a strong fermentation. And so
10x volume, how many yeast cells? Are we doubling the yeast every time? Are we, I think it's like five times, six times, right?
Right. Yeah.
It's like five or six times, I think, right? Per cycle, roughly.
Correct.
Yeah.
Correct. And so then you go up to those 10 times. And so say now you're in 100 liters, 1 hectoliter, close to 1 barrel. Size, you know, from there, you're going into, you know, now you're even at 100 liters, you're out of lab scale.
Yeah.
So we would call that production scale. So we go, our lab, the microbiology lab, there's a few labs here, but there's a microbiology lab that's connected to the production room. They're mm-hmm. both lab clean rooms. But, you know, once it leaves the lab scale, it goes to the production scale where the production team takes it and puts it into our reactors. And then it'll go from that reactor to one more step higher in volume. And then after that process, then they'll cool it down and get to the point of getting the yeast in the stationary phase and getting the yeast so we can collect.
So you can actually collect it, yeah. So what does a reactor look like? Is that, is it look anything like my home brewing equipment or a typical brewing equipment, or is it something different?
It can, and it used to for us. We created our own process. There wasn't a textbook or a course or any kind of examples, really. That so I took my experience from different kinds of yeast to brewer's yeast because of the homebrewing hobby, and I wanted a lot of brewer's yeast for my hobby. So I first started with things like stainless steel polypropylene, which is an autoclavable type of plastic, pharmaceutical grade.
Right.
Plastic. I would use things like that to scale the yeast up, grow it, collect it, and package it. But we now, you know, we have our own process, the patented flex cell process that makes the pure pitch that doesn't have any stainless steel.
Right. And we'll talk about that in a minute, I think. Yeah. But I assume as you're stepping it up, though, you're using a small, are you still using pure pitch all the way now, or how does that work? I don't know.
Yeah. So the pharmaceutical industry, which we compare ourselves to a lot, even though we're making food grade products, we're FDA inspected, and you know, the person who will come from a local biotech company in San Diego, the FDA inspector,
sure,
they know that's pharma grade. They'll come over to White Labs, and they know they're now in a food grade facility. But we built it like pharmaceutical grade because yeast for brewers has an intense requirement for purity.
Right.
Way more than baker's yeast was ever made to, or wine yeast or things. So even though beer is sold at sort of a low price, it's one of the highest purity needs from a microbiology perspective, because all those little bits of wild yeast, other yeast, bacteria, create really noticeable flavors in beer.
Yeah, they do. Absolutely. So as I understand it, when you're doing this, you're basically fermenting lower gravity wort, in order to make, continue to grow the yeast all the way up.
Yeah. So traditionally in the brewing industry, 12 Plato is a kind of standard propagation wort. We do something a little different than that, a little proprietary, but
12 Plato is pretty low. That's, 1004, I think.
Yeah, 1040. Right? Yeah.
Yeah.
So, and the thing that is interesting, right, if you grow yeast, say, 1040.
Yeah.
Versus 1060, you would think if you grow the yeast at 1060, more sugar, more yeast. It's the opposite. If you grow yeast at 1040 versus 1060, you get a higher yield at 1040.
Interesting. And why is that?
Because yeast are incorporating the sugar in a defined way, starting with glucose and getting it working through different sugars until they get to maltose. And the more sugar you put on yeast, just the more other stuff they do with it. You know, they'll send it to amino acid synthesis. It's just loading. It's just eating everything it can, like we do if we have a big plate of food and you don't want to take home any leftovers. You know, so that extra sugar doesn't go through the system slow enough to really create new yeast cells. So if you overload the yeast with sugar, the Crabtree effect is kind of what we're talking about, but the Crabtree effect is still in effect at 12 Plato.
Right.
But if you, at least you find a nice little media, something in the middle where you're still getting the biomass you want, but you know, you're not overloading the cells with carbohydrates.
Yeah, I think Palmer did an episode where he talked about how many sheep you can put on an acre, that kind of a thing.
Oh, okay.
Kind of the same idea, maybe?
I haven't heard that line from him.
Yeah. Well, yeah, John, you know. Sure.
Yeah. He's got his own style.
Too many sheep on one acre and you got problems, right?
That's great.
Yeah. How do you harvest and concentrate the yeast for packaging? How do you go about doing that?
So traditionally in stainless steel, which, you know, is what most people would have used traditionally, even the pharmaceutical industry, that's what they used to use too, of course. You harvest, you have a conical bottom vessel, and you... Now, in brewing, just to take a step back, if this is for a brewery and they have a propagator, they might not necessarily have a conical bottom because they're going to send 10% of that volume over into the fermenters.
Okay.
Now, somebody making yeast like us or really wanting to collect yeast, you'd usually have a conical bottom and you'd harvest the yeast kind of like a brewery does.
So kind of just open up the valve at the bottom of the cone, huh?
Right. But that's not what we do.
No.
Because, you know, you are, once you open the valve at the bottom of the tank, collecting that in the cleanest, closest to sterile manner. How do you do that? How do you not get oxygen ingress? Yep. What you do?
Yep.
You know, and oxygen damages yeast. Not the same way it does in beer and giving off flavors, like skunkiness, right?
Yeah.
But oxygen damages yeast cells just like it damages our own cells through oxidation and mutation.
Makes sense.
So, and not just that. I was thinking, I was saying light struck for beer. But oxygen damages beer because it stales the beer. Oxygen damages yeast through the oxidation I mentioned, and also it makes yeast want to grow.
Yeah, we're talking about steriles, right?
Pardon?
They create steriles, I think, right?
Glycogen.
Yeah.
So oxygen is used to make the steriles. Correct.
Correct. Yeah.
In the process, and that's why we feed our yeast oxygen during all of these propagation processes.
And you do recommend, I know we had this discussion before, but you do recommend using oxygen, whether you're making beer, wine, mead, whatever, right?
Well, yeah, for propagation, it's important. But just remember, if you're adding oxygen, you're allowing other things to grow that don't grow in normal non-oxygenated beer environments. Another reason to have sterile starting materials.
Yeah. I'm talking about obviously before fermentation, right? Aeration, we call it, I guess.
Oh, yeah. Well, yeast are not anaerobic. And, you know, they can't live without oxygen.
Right.
So we have to give them some oxygen. And we've just done a boil that's driven out most of the oxygen.
Yep.
And the transfer can add a 1 or 2 ppm of oxygen, but you need 10. So brewers actively add oxygen, and you have to have the best fermentation. You'll have fermentation without doing that because yeast survive.
But I were talking about, like, a lot of winemakers say we don't need any oxygen, and of course they do get some from the grapes, but, you know,
and they don't boil.
That's true. Absolutely true too. So,
they're not driving that oxygen out. But when I started, you know, 25 years ago, whatever, in this industry, and I started going to wine shows, we started supplying the wine yeast, and I would talk to winemakers, and they'd say, adding oxygen, are you crazy? We don't add oxygen in the beginning of fermentation, but now a lot do.
Yeah.
What they were having before was stuck fermentations. And that was just part of the wine industry. You started fermentations at harvest, you know, around September, October, and you restarted stuck fermentations with new yeast in January. Now that more wineries are adding oxygen at the time they pitch yeast, they're having less stuck fermentations because the yeast grows with that oxygen to the right number and you don't have stuck fermentation. Brewers don't have any stuck fermentations because we've been adding oxygen as an industrial practice for a long time.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, back to packaging. So you mentioned, you don't obviously use a conical fermenter with a concentrator and everything. How do you do it?
Well, packaging yeast is always something that's fascinated me. Like how do you collect it?
Here's another question. How do you separate the yeast from all the other stuff that might be in there? Bits of grain and so on. Yeah.
How do you separate it? How do you collect 70 different strains from a, you know, production environment? How do you not add oxygen? How do you do all this stuff? So as we were growing, I kept working more and more on our yeast collection or packaging. And then if you collect it into something that's not a package.
Yeah.
Which is what currently most people would do, right? You've got to then take it from that collection, call it a brink, call it a 20-liter carboy or something, and then you have to put it into something you're going to sell the yeast in. So that's a second process. And then you've got to also, you know, so it's not when you collect the yeast from a stainless steel tank, it's not into a package. You can't sell it yet. It's going to take more time. And then what some people do is, you know, then say, well, okay, now that's my package date, but it could be in that bottle for a while.
Right. That makes sense.
So we wanted to create, a method where the yeast from the reactor is in a package, QC'd, and ready to sell, with no oxygen pickup and no possibility for introducing contaminants. And so since, again, I've tried to stay tied to the pharmaceutical industry and different trade shows and people and whatever, but I noticed that they were starting to grow yeast in film. You call it bag, but I don't like that word because it doesn't really represent what it is. And the pharmaceutical industry wouldn't use that word. So it's film, but very specialized film that is verified sterile, not CIP stainless steel, which is, you know, think about a human injectable. It gives them a better protection and verifiable. FDA likes it. And then so the pharmaceutical industry switched to growing yeast in film quite a while ago. And so Genentech and these other companies, every plant's a little different, but use a lot of film. And so I kind of thought my moment of like, whoa, was just thinking if we grew yeast in film, we could seal it in the film. See, because we want the yeast. Those pharmaceutical companies I mentioned aren't really concerned about that because they want the stuff that comes out of the yeast or bacteria, the drug they're making. We want the yeast. So if we could grow it in film, we could seal it in the film, sealers.
Right.
And there's your package. There's your no oxygen pickup because you're not transferring anything. There's your no introduction of potential contaminants from the environment. And so that led us down the path to create Pure Pitch.
And that is, of course, your Pure Pitch packaging, which you have in, you know, anything from a little tiny package. In fact, I got a couple in the fridge here, up to much larger ones or multiple liters, right?
Yeah, all the yeast is sold like that. We do some custom pours for breweries that want cap. We do some blends and some like vault strains in vials still for certain different reasons. But we grow it all the same. Mm-hmm. And it's sealed into the Pure Pitch packages at the time we collect it. Then we can do some custom pours or vials. But we're working on upgrades to Pure Pitch. And we had a lot of momentum going on this for the last year before this current situation is going on with COVID-19.
Yeah.
But we're still working on it. We're working on some innovations, which was always the intention of Pure Pitch, but real active innovations now that's going to make Pure Pitch easier to use. Everything's going to be able to be in Pure Pitch. And it's listening to our customers, homebrewers, commercial breweries, so on, that say, I want this, I want this, I want this. We've got this big list. We've got our own list of what on the manufacturing side would be better and more efficient and so on, better for the staff. And that's all wrapping into these upgrades that are coming out later this year.
Now, stepping back for a minute, separation, do you actually have to worry about separating the yeast from other trube or whatever that's coming out? Because I know, you know, I get a lot of grain bits and stuff when I certainly make my work.
Yeah. So we can either make yeast. So the wort is all grain, right? So
right. I would assume you make it very much like I do, right?
Right.
Except you probably don't use any hops, right?
We use a little bit.
A little bit, okay.
We're really trying to make, but we're, it's liquid hops, but we're trying to make a very, when we're making brewer's yeast, different than wine yeast and different than some other things, substrates, we're really trying to make a very, we didn't used to, but we've, trials and trials and trials showed us that the closer this is to beer wort, the better the yeast is going to behave. And so, it's going to be ready just to attack that, you know, right from a physiological standpoint as well.
That's really cool.
And there's interactions between yeast and hops. Yeah. So we can either start with an extract, like a powder or a syrup, that's and sterilize that in a pressure cooker. So there's where you don't have a lot of grain bits and things. You have some trub. Or you can do it in a brew house with all grain starting materials with a really good wool pool. So we have a mixture of both. We have a four-vessel brew house that produces sterile wort because it's the kettle and the whirlpool are pressure vessels that we can get up to that 250 degrees Fahrenheit.
Makes sense. So you just do a really hot whirlpool, huh?
Yeah, under pressure.
Under pressure, of course.
Yeah, so, and both tanks have to be under pressure, and there's some engineering to get a liquid moved under pressure like that.
Yeah.
But, and then we use that in San Diego, we use that same four vessel brew house with a specialized kettle and whirlpool to make beer on to sell as White Labs Brewing Company in our two tap rooms. And then we turn off those, that system. Mm-hmm. So, because in a traditional beer, you want to volatilize things. Otherwise, you're going to have some off flavor, sulfur, and things. So,
sure.
So we turn those off and make smaller batches of beer.
Wow. That's really cool. So does that separate most of the debris out, I guess, when you do that process?
Yeah. And we want a little bit of Trub. It's part of the ingredient process, the type of what we're trying to make. Trub has some fatty acid material that is, rather than adding fatty acid material back in for good yeast growth, we take advantage of already what's there in a measured amount, you know, so and distribute that among all the reactors for that day. Again, because every day there's the petri dish is being worked on, the first step in the culture, the next step, yeast started, yeast collected. And so every day there's a set of reactors started, and that wort will be moved into those, so the wort's all the same in each reactor. And very so there's cool. A little bit of Trub. That's a long answer for that question, but you won't see a big cap of Trub, for example, on top of our yeast.
Makes sense, yeah. So go over some of the advantages for the pure pitch technology then. We've already talked through quite a few of them, but I thought maybe give you a chance to summarize here.
Yeah, it prevents the very minimal oxygen uptake, which gives us our really long shelf lives. So if you take our 6 month old yeast or 4 or 5 month old yeast and compare it to anything else, it's going to have a lot higher viability.
Yeah, I think even at 6 months, the numbers, at least your lab sent me numbers a while ago, is like 68%, I think, or something like that, which is very high, really.
Yeah.
Most of them are well below 50% at that point for liquid yeast. So.
Correct. And the film, since we blow the film, we dial in exactly what the film should have property-wise. So it releases CO2 gas. So, you know, think about yeast in storage. It slowly makes some CO2. And in our in the past with our vials, you'd open them up. Sometimes they have a lot of gas in them. That shortens the shelf life. And so the film will release that gas slowly. It's not just goes right out, but it has to develop a certain partial pressure. But that keeps the CO2 from building up in the culture. So less oxygen in the beginning, less CO2 buildup are two of the big factors why the yeast has a longer shelf life and what makes pure pitch so unique. And the fact that the yeast was collected in that film and sealed, so you're not introducing any kind of contaminants from filling. The filling is always the part where a final product has a chance of obtaining a problem. I mean, think of breweries, think of any kind of food and beverage being packaged. That's your critical control point. And we were able to get rid of that and minimize that critical control point by harvesting the yeast right in the film.
And you also talked about how you know, you're literally taking sterilization, working with sterile wort all the way through the entire process too.
Right. Sterile wort through the whole process. And lots of checks. QC samples, and it's not released until that final QC, which is already from the film. See, it's not like think of a big can line. Oh, you take a couple of cans out and QC those. But breweries have had lots of troubles with, well, every sixth can has a problem because of one of the filler heads, right? So you can put that same analogy to any packaging line. For us, the yeast is in the film, and before it's divided, a piece of that is taken off. So that is completely representative of all the yeast in the film.
Very cool. That's awesome. Can you talk for a minute about what the commercial packaging looked like? I think everybody, at least most people listening, are familiar with what your homebrew size packaging looks like, but and what sizes are available for commercial use?
They're bigger. seriously, that's kind of the difference.
They're still in film, though, right?
They're still in film. 2 liters is the most common size we sell. And increments of 2 liter, people buy 10 liters, they'll buy 5 of them, they'll buy 50 of them, they'll buy. And so 2 liters is a very typical size for us for a commercial brewery. That'll pitch average of 10 hectoliters, depending on the beer, sometimes 5, depending what pitch rate they want.
So two liters, 10 hectoliters, 10 barrels ish. I don't know.
Yeah. Close enough. East.
Yeah.
But actually on the calculators we get to specific differences, but
I'm sure, yeah. But that's awesome.
Yeah, so it's a 2 liter pure pitch that just looks like a much bigger homebrew pure pitch. It's got the same film. It is from the same bulk vessel. So we call that bulk yeast. When we seal the yeast in the film, now we've got bulk yeast. We take a piece of that off for QC, and then we slice and dice it. It's already sealed, right? So there is no more input of anything. It's now just on heat sealers, making small homebrew packages, making 2 liter packages, depending on what we need to fill the orders. And every day when those reactors are harvested, by the end of that day where that lot, after it clears QC, right, it's stored, cold, then it's what I'm trying to say is once that day's lot goes to packaging where the heat sealers are, at the end of the day, it's all in a package. There's right. No yeast left behind to be packaged someday later. Nice. For some kind of order that we might not have. We seal it. A lot of it's already on order. We might be shipping out the next day or two or the next week or two.
Awesome. Hey, can you talk, Chris, a little bit about the quality control? I know we mentioned it briefly when we were talking about the lab, but what kind of steps do you take all the way along to make sure you're getting a pure product out the door?
The traceability, and that's one thing the FDA looks for as well, especially for export. But the traceability of our own raw ingredients tied to that lot number, the lot number moves through all the way from Petri dish to final product. And we use little scanners, on the film, whether it's transferring from to the next vessel. So the operator is transferring that lot. It's flowing through our advanced manufacturing system, is what they call it in NetSuite. And so all of the testing that we do is also feeds into that lot. So, for example, when we have that bulk yeast sealed in that vessel, and a piece of that goes to the lab, we will take that and we will put on the Petri dishes. We will look at a microscope. We will HLP, for example. So we'll look for wild yeast and bacteria. And those have to be zero on our zero CFUs to clear the yeast. We get the pH. Again, we get the cell count. And that's all printed on a QC sheet. So it's very transparent. The cell count's there. The date that it cleared QC is there. Not when we packaged it or whatever, but the date it cleared QC.
Nice.
And all the results.
And so that for packages, every lot, right?
Every lot.
Yeah.
Every lot. It's a live QC. So on the 2 liter packages, the label's big enough to print all of that information. So the pro brewer sees it right there.
Nice.
On the homebrew packages are smaller. So you go to eastman.com and put in that lot number. You don't have to sign in to eastman.com. You can just put that lot number and it'll give you the full QC sheet.
Oh, nice. I didn't even know that. That's awesome.
Yeah.
So, you can probably pull up all the, all the different off flavors and everything, right?
Yeah. If you want, you grab a QC sheet for every yeast you use, put it in a binder, take a screenshot of it, if that's easier.
That's really cool. I had no idea.
And we're making that, we're tying that in a little bit. I talked about the innovations in pure pitch coming out later. We've got some cool things in the QC part too. And that's going to be part of that. A little bit easier to find and, to get your to get your, rather than going in and typing it in and stuff like that.
And then I want to ask you about your favorite subject, which is scheduling. How do you schedule all these things?
We have to pay people to do it, right? We have staff that do it. That's those production planners. So we went to NetSuite in 2016, and it caused us some problems for a while because it's a hard system to work with. And we were missing a lot of orders that year, and then, you know, made a few people mad, which never like to do. But we've really got it down now. And, you know, it's ordered by Oracle, and you see them advertising sometimes on TV. But it's a really powerful system. And it's good because it's expensive, but it's good and it's powerful. So all the orders are in there. All of just about everything is in there, right? So the production planners are looking at what's on order and kind of globally, right? Because they're trying to plan Copenhagen's production, again, Asheville, San Diego, and where all these orders are coming in from. And when somebody orders from us, we give them a date when they get it. That's what a lot of people want. Retail stores are a little different. We make up certain batches per week, and then they know how much. They can also see exactly what's there when they're ordering. But for the commercial brewery, if they want, you know, 4 liters of California ale yeast next Thursday, we got to deliver it to them next Thursday, right? So we got to ship it Wednesday overnight. It's got to be ready that Wednesday. It's got to have all the QC done. It's got to have everything done. And so that's all part of that planning.
And then, of course, you got to back up. You got to back up. You got to back up the production, and then all the way to the lab, right?
Oh yeah,
for a lot of these batches. Yeah.
You know, if it's a private strain, we won't have a freeze plate because maybe we make it once a year or twice a year or something for a commercial brewery or distillery or something. So that's going to have a different timeline, all built into NetSuite. But the planners are looking at all of these strains, you know, all the spreadsheets. And I mean, I could ask them for anything. I could ask them for anything about any strain coming up or past, and they'll give me a spreadsheet for it.
That's They're really awesome. Cool.
And it's really made us be able to scale up to the point we are because everything just used to be chaos. You know, I mean, the Excel sheets. We don't have any of that stuff anymore. It's all in NetSuite, and it allows us to fulfill our orders. I mean, even a couple years ago, we were still having a hard time with homebrew stores under shipping things. Like, they'd order 100 or something, we'd ship them 50. Well, that's all we had. Sorry. Yeah. We don't really do that anymore because we know exactly how much we're making.
That's awesome.
And finding more. So those have been huge achievements.
Well, Chris, we're getting near the end, but I wanted to ask one more question. You mentioned you got some future plans. You got some future improvements to Pure Pitch and so on coming out. Can you talk a little bit about those?
Yeah, it's listening to what homebrewers want, what commercial breweries want, some other industries want, and, you know, again, what our own staff wants. So we were going to release this all at Craft Brewers Conference, you know, April in San Antonio, Texas.
I don't think that's happening this time, right?
That's not happening. I'm pretty sure everything's just going to be 2021. I don't think we're going to have a lot of conferences this year. But even on our reduced schedules, we're still working on all of those, plus some other innovations. We've created all these great teams at the end of last year to work on a lot of innovation projects. So we're spending some of our time right now doing that. But, of course, a lot of the prototypes and other things we need are also closed factories or partially shut down factories. So everything's kind of slower right now.
Yeah.
And if somebody's working a 4-hour shift versus an 8-hour shift or 6-hour shift instead of a whatever, you know, their time's also a little smaller. But we're moving these things along, and we still want to come out with these innovations later this year.
Can you talk a little bit about some of them, or are they all top secret still?
Well, we just came out with a new nutrient that was designed for mostly designed for hard cider, but you really need a lot of nitrogen for hard cider.
Right.
We're working on a new website. We just released some online training classes, and we're also now offering some free. Those are for cost, but we have some free webinars going on every Wednesday. So I'm doing one next Wednesday. on 25 years of homebrewing. Each week we're just going to do
I think that's a great thing. In fact, I'm looking at trying to find a webinar service, maybe offer some of that too while everybody's locked down, you know. I think it's a good thing.
The platforms are great. You know, there's jokes, you know, Zoom's in the news a lot because of people using Zoom for their meetings. And there's some pretty funny sketches on that because it does sound a little crazy. But we've been using Zoom for years. We've been doing the multiple facilities and some offsite workers. We've been communicating like this for a while. Our phones make no difference if they're in the office or, you know, the phones people are calling for orders or at somebody's house. So we've kind of, at least by accident, are able to still work together and do these things even during this time right now. And then Zoom also has a great kind of webinar feature that I don't know if maybe a little pricey or not compared to other platforms, but because they work in increments of 100, you know. But we had a big we did a webinar this Wednesday with Joe Kurowski, our head of brewing technology. And kind of runs all that hot side of everything here, including the beers. And it was great. We had a couple hundred people join.
Nice. That's awesome. Well, Chris, I really appreciate you stepping up, especially I had a couple cancellations this month and thrown into a little bit of chaos, but I'm trying to keep the podcast going and certainly my intent to keep it going. And I appreciate you stepping in at the last minute here.
Well, good luck keeping it going. See the sun's coming down on my screen here.
I see that. Yeah, it's a little bit of splash there on the video.
But thanks for doing it. I'm happy to do it. You know, these are tough times for everybody since it's impacting everybody's bottom line. If you're not working, and so, but we will get through it, and
we will.
Our country's going to learn a lot.
Absolutely. And we are all in it together. Everybody in the world is going through exactly the same things you and I are going through right now. So,
yeah.
Anyways, thanks for being there, Chris. Really appreciate you coming on the show. Thanks again.
Thanks, Brad. I look forward to the next one.
So, again, my guest today was Dr. Chris White, president and founder of White Labs, one of the largest commercial beer yeast providers in the world. Chris, always a pleasure.
Thank you.
Well, a big thank you to Chris White for joining me this week. Thanks also to Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine. They're currently offering 20% off their all-access subscription pass with access to videos, brewing courses, exclusive articles, and the amazing Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine. Go to beerandbrewing.com/beersmith to get your all-access pass today. Again, that's beerandbrewing.com/beersmith. And also the BrewEasy, brew big in small spaces with the best all-grain ultra-compact system available. The BrewEasy's revolutionary setup combines bass barge efficiency, brew-in-a-bag simplicity, and the work clarification of a rim system. It's easy to set up, easy to operate, and easy on the eyes. Electric and propane models are available. It's also the system that I personally brew on. Visit BlickmanEngineering.com for more information. Again, that's BlickmanEngineering.com. And Beersmith 3 is available for both desktop and mobile platforms. Beersmith 3 adds mead, wine, and cider support, new whirlpool hop options, support for high-altitude beer brewing, and a whole lot more. Check out Beersmith 3 and get your free 21-day trial today from beersmith.com. Thank you for listening. I hope you have a great brewing week.